You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A growing number of colleges no longer require admissions exams for students. Coming up, we'll look at how the pandemic has forced colleges and universities to change their testing policies and what that means for prospective students. First, many people have moments in which they're faced with a realization that changes how they view the world. Our next guest had that moment at age 10 when he was faced with the fact that many people would respond to him differently based on the color of his skin and would make harmful assumptions based on it. Devin Snyder is a civil rights activist. He grew up in Fond du Lac and is a graduate of UW-Madison. His recent opinion piece for Fox Valley 365 is titled The Never-Ending Timeline of Racism. You can also find a link to it over at WPR.org/Central Time. Devin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You start your piece by relating an interaction that you and your mom had with your fifth grade teacher. Can you share that with us?
Yes, that is correct. So when I was in fifth grade at Parkside Elementary School, we were at a parent-teacher conference. And my teacher at the time started off the conversation essentially telling my mother that she thought I was going to be a bad kid and that she thought I was going to be trouble, but it kind of shocked her that, as it turned out, that I wasn't bad and I actually was smart. And after that happened, my mom kind of told her off and we abruptly left. And me being 10 years old, I really wasn't sure kind of what happened. And I didn't understand what was going through, you know, my mom's head at that time. And then when we got to the car, that's when my mom, for the first time in my life at the age of 10, had explained racism to her 10-year-old black child.
Can you talk about that conversation and what she tried to share with you then?
Yep. So she essentially told me that my teacher made a preconceived notion about me based off my skin color, and that she told me that, unfortunately, in today's society, me being black is going to come with some troubles, that people are going to judge me based off my skin color, that when it comes to the police, that I must always comply, even if I'm not in the wrong, so I can make it back to her. And that she even told me herself that her having black children herself, that even her own family members won't talk to her.
Well, get into some more of the stories you share in your piece, but can you talk about why you decided to share these stories ranging from age 10 to your adult life now?
Yeah, no problem. So kind of, I'm from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. It's a small town, kind of a hick town. And I kind of was just getting sick of the ignorant, racist, bigot posts that I kept seeing on my news feed. Essentially, people, you know, were stating that, you know, racism doesn't exist in Fond du Lac, or, you know, that did you guys ever think that maybe if you didn't break the law that maybe you wouldn't have these interactions with the police? So I was just kind of seeing things like that that just made me mad, and I just felt that I needed to share my story. And that was kind of the reason why I wrote my story, to kind of educate the people of Fond du Lac that even though you might not see racism or experience it yourself, doesn't mean that it's not existing. And my whole intent of writing that article, like, I didn't have these intentions that, you know, it was going to go viral. My whole intention was just to, you know, kind of shut up the ignorant people in my hometown and, like, show them that, hey, look at me. You know, I'm college educated. I went to the best college, you know, in our state. You know, I've done a lot of things and I still experience racism. So I complied with the laws and still I, you know, experienced this. So you're valid there, you know, not your points are not valid, essentially.
And then the next story you share was 2 years later in middle school now in Fond du Lac. This time it involved the police. What happened then?
Yeah, so I made the track team in seventh grade at Sabish Middle School, and I was jogging, practicing, because for track, I ran the 400. So I was good at sprinting, but with the 400, it's kind of long distance and sprinting, so I wasn't really good at long distance running. So I was practicing just kind of running on Forest Avenue and Fond du Lac Avenue when I get stopped by two police officers. And I am 12 years old at this time. I'm scared. I'm shaking. My mom's words echo through my head again. Comply with the police, even though you're not in the wrong. They start patting me down. They start asking me questions, why I was running. as they were patting me down, they found an iPod in my pocket. Then they start to question me about the iPod. They ask me who I stole it from. That was the first question. Who'd you steal this iPod from? I'm stuttering. I'm 12 years old, shaking, don't know what to say, trying to get the words out. They keep asking me over and over again, like, who'd you steal this iPod from? And finally, I was able to get the words out that I didn't steal the iPod, that it was mine. That if you look on the back of the iPod, you can see engraved, it says Devin Snyder. And then when they saw that, they kind of smirked, you know, told me it was my lucky day, and they told me to head back home. And I ran as fast as I can back to my house. I was bawling. And I just ran to, like, my mom and told her what happened. And that's the day I realized, like, true racism, that what my mom told me 2 years prior is exactly 100% true.
Talking to Devin Snyder, civil rights activist. His piece on Fox Valley 365 has gone viral. It's titled The Never-Ending Timeline of Racism. Devin, you recount another story where you were told you had a lucky day, this time not in Fond du Lac. I think this was in Madison after you bought a new car.
Yes. So before I bought a new car, I had this piece of crap 2000 Pontiac Grand Am that lasted me for a while, and it finally died, and I was saving up, and I just got a promotion at my job, and I transferred to the east side for my job, so I needed a car before I was able to walk to work, so I had no other choice. So I picked up a car from CarMax on the west side of Madison, a nice luxury car, way better than the car I've ever owned. And I didn't even own the car for 5 minutes, and I get pulled over. The officer comes to my door, knocks on the window, asks me, you know, for my license and registration, asks me if I know why I got pulled over. I told him, I said, I honestly do not know why I just got pulled over. I literally just picked this car up. Before I even got that, he told me that I did a rolling stop and I didn't have my lights on. I just bought a luxury car that has automatic lights. Even before I got this luxury car, my 2004 Pontiac Grand had automatic lights. So you're telling me that you pulled me over because my lights weren't on when I have automatic lights and it was dark and my lights were on? So that was just his excuse to pull me over. I got pulled over for driving while being in a nice car. So then after he went back to his car to check, after I get my license and registration, then he went back to his car to, you know, check my record to make sure, you know, it was my car and everything. He literally came back, told me it was my lucky day and to head back home.
Those are just a few of the stories you share. But another common theme is that when you talk about this with your white friends in Fond du Lac, and I think in Madison also, people respond by downplaying it. Is that a fair trend?
Yes, they try to downplay it, try to say, you know, I'm kind of like too sensitive, or like the one instance I kind of shared in my article was about when I was at a Badger game and I saw a white guy was dressed as Obama with a noose over his head. And I remember being at that Badger game and I told my friend, like, I'm leaving, like, I can't be there. I was sick to my stomach. And we left. And he told me, and I told him, like, that's not right. And he was like, that's freedom of speech. Like, whether you like it or not, you know, whether you agree with that or not, you know, you have that right to that. And that's when I kind of said there's a difference between, you know, freedom of speech and hate speech. And there's a difference between disguising freedom of speech, you know, and that. Like, and I kind of always got that from my white friends growing up, from being called the whitest black person they knew. And that always used to make me mad, because it's like they always reminded me on a daily basis that, you know, I was black. And then on top of that, they wanted to add that I was the whitest black person they knew, because, you know, I was one of the most educated people they knew. And they made their own preconceived notion, you know, of what is and isn't normal behavior for a black person. And that's what made me mad. It's because these are supposed to be my friends, you know, my best friends. And even though they might not have known at the time that what they were saying was a racist, it had a race, you know, racist undertone. And like I said, they said those things because of their preconceived notions of what is and isn't normal behavior for, you know, a black person.
Very briefly, Devin, these were your stories, and a lot of people, a lot of black people have stories like these, right?
Yes. That, I guess, what the good thing about me writing this article that I didn't expect, like, so when I first wrote this article, I just expected, you know, maybe a couple shares, maybe like 50 likes. Well, like I said, I got over 15,000 shares, and it reached people in Paris and Nicaragua and Canada. And what was the most rewarding thing for me for writing this article is the countless other black people that messaged me daily, thanking me for telling my story, for telling our story, for articulating so well that they couldn't, for saying the similar experiences that they've gone through, you know, for telling me they have tears in my eyes, that, you know, that they're literally thanking me for telling our story. And it's just a sad truth that, like, it's not black people's job to teach, to, you know, share their experiences with white people for them to believe that racism exists. That wasn't my intent of sharing this. I just had to share it because I was sick of people, you know, thinking that it doesn't exist, or just because it doesn't happen to them that it's not going on. And
we have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Devin Snyder. Sorry to cut you out. Devin Snyder, civil rights activist. His piece, The Never-Ending Timeline of Racism, linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the 100 best works of writing by African-American women and the impact their work has had on our society. First, since schools began closing their doors because of the coronavirus, colleges and universities started putting less weight on standardized tests because in many cases, kids couldn't take them. As the pandemic wore on, more schools followed with test optional policies, some for a year, others two or three. And even before coronavirus, some schools were moving away from the ACT and SAT. McCall Kurlander is a professor and chair of the School of Education at the University of California, Davis. She focuses on education policy and evaluation. McCall, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
What has been leading some colleges and universities to start backing away from exams like the ACT and SAT in recent years?
I think in the most recent year, it's obviously the uncertainty of having the test and amidst our pandemic. And so that would be probably the reason we're seeing a lot of activity in this area in this past year. But I think in years prior to that, as we've seen this, it would be because of critiques that the SAT or the ACT is not providing the information that colleges desire in understanding students' potential for college success, or that it's really overlapped with what they might learn from grades or other sources of information. And then probably a greater concern over equity, and that is that the tests that some students might underperform or have less access to preparation materials or test prep and retake opportunities in a way that disadvantages certain groups and makes the test less accessible and less predictive for some subgroups more than others.
The selling point of the ACT and SAT, as I understand it anyway, is that it's supposed to predict the potential for success for that high school student going into college. Do we know if that works out? Is there enough research to where we could say, yeah, it does, or no, it doesn't?
Yeah, there is enough research that suggests that the SATs and the ACTs do predict first-year college success above and beyond high school grades, and that is why they have been used by so many colleges for so long. So, yes, they do have predictive power. The question is, you know, of course, how much, and is it, you know, is the sort of benefit of the additional predictive power above and beyond grades and other inputs, you know, outweigh the cost that others, that, you know, critics of these tests propose, such as equity or the equity and access to the test and to test prep and to other sources of information, and to the fact that we continue to sort of see disparities on these tests. So again, that's not necessarily because of the test so much as sort of what these tests are also picking up about students' prior academic and schooling opportunities.
Right. So if I'm hearing you right, that test might show that I'm going to be good in college, but it may be that I have the educational and maybe financial resources that make me good at the test. And that's the same reason I'm going to do well in college. The test just is an indicator of those underlying differences, socioeconomic differences between people. Is that a possibility?
That is not just a puzzle. That's exactly right. You just hit it on the nail. That's exactly what it picks up. That's correct.
If I am a college or university, I guess, admissions person, what do I look to replace the ACT or SAT, either this year because of COVID or because I want to get rid of it altogether?
Yeah, I think you're looking for, multiple sources of information on how students are going to perform. And I think we've probably too long relied on sort of first year grades as the only measure. We want to make sure these students are able to perform and do college level coursework. And so their grades continue to be the single best sources of that information. But people worry about sort of, courses looking different across different schools and grades also not necessarily capturing that. So I think you also want to think about taking grades in the context of students' access to quality and curricula and rigorous college level prep in their high schools. And so taking grades in conjunction with, for example, school rank or other kind of access to, like I said, more advanced coursework, IT courses, dual enrollment courses, international baccalaureate programs. And so you want to think about sort of the quality of that high school experience, not just the grades and performance, but the quality of those courses. We care a lot about what students are doing when they're not in school, other activities, investment of time, whether it's to support their families or to play an instrument or sports, right? So we care about sort of, colleges often care about what students are bringing in for broader kind of the campus community beyond just how they're going to perform academically, but also their sort of maturity and other aspects about their lives that would suggest that they would perform well in college. And so sometimes those extracurriculars matter too. Standardized tests may still play a role, whether it's the SAT or ACT or other tests that states use for their accountability systems that can also be considered.
If I'm trying to assess the value of the high school experience, the rigorous coursework, the extracurriculars, doesn't that risk the same problem that kid in the wealthy school district might have a better funded calculus program or orchestra program or whatever, better access to the sort of things I'm looking for?
Absolutely, yes. And not only that, but I think the fear around sort of access to test prep and test opportunities could be applied to any of those other inputs, right? So if we think that one of the reasons we had standardized tests is because we wanted to standardize sort of access. But, if people can sort of gain that and get, advance their test scores, they can also advance sort of other extracurricular activities. And so I think for any input we use, we're going to want to pay attention very carefully that it isn't weighted too heavily and that there are important sort of tests for sort of how the distribution of who benefits from certain inputs matters a lot if we're trying to make sure we reduce inequality in access by income and by race, ethnicity. In terms of your question about high schools, it's actually why the high school context matters. We know that there's a lot of differences between schools in access to quality curriculum as well as within schools. And so what you're trying to do is make sure that you account for both differences between those resources that exist across communities and high schools and the students they serve, and also within the high school, are students taking in very competitive colleges. We want to make sure students are basically availing themselves to the most rigor they could get given the context that they're in.
We're talking to McCall Kurlander, professor and chair of the School of Education at the University of California, Davis, looking at the ACT, the SAT, and college admissions. Some schools have been moving away from those standardized exams, a lot more doing so, as she says, during the COVID-19 outbreak and the disruptions that has caused. McCall, I'm asking questions in one broad brush, but there might be a big difference in what, say, a very selective, I don't know, Ivy League school is looking for versus that local community college. Is it not fair to take a one-size-fits-all approach, I guess, like I've been doing here?
Yeah, I would say that we've spent a lot of time focused on these tests because of the competitive environment. It's very selective schools. But the fact is the majority of Americans are going to college in much more broad access, open access institutions where these play much, are much less significant in their impacts on college admissions.
The idea of the standardized tests, I think, again, was to have an objective measure of students' readiness for college and who the best students are going to be. Is it possible to have an objective, a non-subjective measure of these incoming students?
Probably not completely, no. I think any input we use will have, will suffer some critique. And I think the answer here is to make sure that we do a lot of, that internally in higher education, We both include multiple measures, allowing students to really, students who may not maybe underperforming in one area can, you know, can show their strength in another area. So we want to use, you know, multiple factors. At the University of California, for example, we use holistic review, where there's 14 factors, of which the SAT and ACT was just one until recently. It's been, it's not going to be utilized, right? And so it's just, but again, the standardized tests were just one of 14 factors. And I think we want to both balance sort of how many, you know, what is looked at across campuses, along with clear investigations of sort of who benefits from certain inputs and who doesn't, particularly at selective admissions, which is a zero-sum game.
If somebody, McCall, came to you from a, say, big statewide public university system, whether that's California or Wisconsin, and said, McCall, what should we do when it comes to the SAT and ACT right now? What would your suggestions be?
Well, I think so. That's a tough one because I am in a state that has actually decided to do this. I think given our current environment and the stresses that students have been under, it's the right decision to have moved away from this test. I would say that I want to make sure that we have some at public universities have a really big responsibility to ensure that they're transparent and fair in how they do admissions. And I think we want to make sure that the inputs that we use, in fact, are seen as a really open and accessible to all students. And while we continue to have really big disparities in some of our standardized tests, I believe they should be used with really great caution and should not be weighted so heavily in admissions. And so I applaud the University of California for rethinking the use of the SAT. And I also am encouraged by the fact that they're not necessarily abandoning tests altogether and are going to look closely at California standardized tests and the existing one or possibly a new one that would also make sure that students have other ways to demonstrate their abilities when applying for college.
We'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
McCall Kurlander is a professor and chair of the School of Education at the University of California, Davis. We talked to her about the growing number of colleges that say they'll no longer require admissions exams for applicants. Coming up, we'll check out a list of 100 great books by African-American women, from Zora Neale Hurston to N.K. Jemisin, and the contributions they've made to American culture and history. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to a nutritionist about healthy eating in the summertime, and you can get answers to some of your nutrition questions. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Juneteenth, the day in 1865 that the last enslaved African Americans in the United States were told that they were free. We thought it was a good occasion to revisit a conversation we had earlier this year about a newly compiled list called the Zora Canon. It includes 100 of the greatest works by African-American women going back to 1859. Morgan Jerkins is the senior editor at Zora, that's Medium's online space for women of color, and a visiting assistant professor at Columbia University's School of the Arts. She's the author of This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America. And her second book, Wandering in Strange Lands, A Daughter of the Great Migration Reclaims Her Roots, is due out in August. Morgan led the team who put this list together. Also with us, Sandra Adell is the F.U. Bascom Professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's the author of several books, including a memoir titled Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen, and the editor of the anthology Contemporary Plays by African-American Women, 10 Complete Plays. Well, this list, the Zora Canon and Medium's Magazine, are named for Zora Neale Hurston, so that's a great place to start. Morgan, can you talk a little bit about the importance of Zora Neale Hurston and why you're using her name and why she features so prominently in this list of 100 books?
Oh, man, I don't even know where to start. I mean, Zora Neale Hurston was just a multi-hyphenate type of artist. I mean, she did ethnography, anthropology, she wrote short stories, she documented folklore for people of the South, and she encompassed so many different things. And what I'm so thankful about is that Zora Neale Hurston has such a vibrant afterlife. You know, she was rediscovered for her works back in the 1970s by Alice Walker, and she had an unmarked grave at the time. And so it's wonderful to be in this sort of cultural moment where there are many Black women, including myself, who are existing in this space where we can give honor to those like her who came before us, thus Zora Magazine.
And Sandra, let's talk about the importance of doing a project like this. There have been all these African-American women authors. Can you talk about the importance of making sure we remember them and keep coming back to their work?
Well, first of all, Morgan, thank you so much for you and your team to put this together. For your book, This Will Be My Undoing, I enjoyed reading your essays. This is very important because, let me say that those of us who are scholars have been compiling lists and bibliographies for a long time, but they're in scholarly books and journals. This is a compilation, and it's very comprehensive. And the important thing for me and for those of us who are still looking for more works to add to our ongoing canon is that it's online. And so I think that after looking at what they've done here, I think what's very important is that people who are not African-Americanist can't keep saying they can't find work by Black, women authors, because here it is at their fingertips. And so I just see a great potential for this. And I'm happy that it's getting the attention.
And Morgan, the author Caitlin Greenidge wrote an intro for this list. She mentioned a Toni Morrison quote where Morrison talks about African-American women being read for sociology or moral reason, the idea that this is the broccoli of our reading. This list is not just about important historical documents. These are good reads too, right?
Yes, of course. I think what we wanted to do for this particular type of project is that we wanted to show people that Black women can write about a range of things. They wrote about their ancestors. They wrote about activism. They also wrote about sex, and they also wrote about intergenerational trauma. And so, I mean, I want to argue that Black women's writings, the meat, the potatoes, the broccoli, the dessert, you know what I'm saying? And so I agree. It's like it's so comprehensive, and no one has an excuse anymore.
Yeah, and the other important thing is that it's fiction, nonfiction, as she mentioned, poetry, and other documents. And that's another aspect of its comprehensiveness. So it's crossing, for those of us who work in African American studies, we are interdisciplinary. So for us, this is going to be useful in all of our different areas, in sociology, literature, the arts, and history.
Morgan, can you talk about the process that went into selecting this diverse group of works from just 100 works that might have been tough to narrow it down?
Absolutely. I mean, I will say it didn't just come from the team. We had to have a village of people. So when I was given this responsibility to start this special package, I reached out to other women whose works I have admired for years. And I asked them, you know, can you tell me about the 20 books that really meant something to you? 20 books by African-American authors. And magically, they were able to fill in many gaps. For example, you know, usually when you see lists of books to read by authors in general, there may be a deficit in poetry. Mm-hmm. There may be a deficit in anthologies. And we didn't have that with this list. I mean, we had sociologist Dr. Tressie McMillan Codum, who provided so many scholarly works. Then we had Professor Imani Perry also brought in the plays and all of these different type of collections. And then you had like Jesmyn Ward, Malaika Adaro, Margot Jefferson, and Ayanna Mathis bringing all this fiction and nonfiction. And we had the Zora team, when we looked at the list, we narrowed it down because there was a lot of overlaps. Of course, you're going to have overlaps with, of course, like the Toni Morrisons, the Alice Walkers, the Zora Neale Hurstons, of course. And we made sure that there weren't any overlaps in that way with, you know, one person nominating the same book over and over. But also we wanted to make sure in terms of the decades that there were full in each decade. So you might have suggested a book in the 1920s. We might have suggested a book in the 1960s and 70s in tandem with the civil rights movement. And that's pretty much how we did it.
Talking to Morgan Jerkins, senior editor at Zora, and Sandra Adele from UW-Madison. We're looking at a new list from Zora, the 100 great works by African-American women authors in the United States. I want to start naming names. We're not going to get to all 100 books. Sandra, I want to get your response. What are some that struck you from this list that you were excited to see there?
Well, just about everything that I like. What struck me were the things that I have not read. And that's very important. Also, they have another list. What is it called, Morgan? 10 writers, women writers that you...
Yes, the 10 Black Women Writers to Watch. Yep.
10 Black Women Writers to Watch. Yeah. And that's important to me because, you know, I teach regularly. I'm a literature professor. I teach literature regularly. And I find myself stopping at Toni Morrison. And it's like, okay, there is a post-Toni Morrison life, you know, and world. And so, for example, Jasmine Award is somebody some of my other younger colleagues have said, you need to read this. So there are things, and poetry. Morgan Jenkins has a collection of poems, right? Morgan title?
Oh, Morgan Parker. Morgan Parker.
Oh, no, Morgan Parker. I'm sorry. Morgan Parker. I got you mixed up there. I got you a poet as well. But those are some newer poets that I don't know. And so that's the other important part of this is that it's bringing, you know, we're well into the 21st century now. So who are the new writers? Who are the new, in all of the different genres? And for me, in the different areas, rather, for me, it's literature. So there are some names on that list that I will certainly be reading and adding to. My list of things that we teach. And keep in mind also, when we're teaching, we're creating the canon. And the canon's always going to shift. Or maybe we can call it the tradition of African-American women writers. So it's always going to shift. There's room for more things to be brought into the so-called canon, the tradition. And that's a good thing.
And Morgan, can you highlight some of the early, we just heard about some of the more recent ones. Can you highlight some of the earlier ones on your list that stand out to you?
Oh, man, The Red Record by Ida B. Wells. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, she was publishing in 1895 and talking about lynching and other sorts of racially terroristic acts towards Black people in the South. To be able to document that and remain alive, I mean, that stood out to me. And it actually got me a little bit emotional when I saw the list because I had never read the book. And I'll be honest, I hadn't heard of that book until someone brought it up. And it just shows me that there's always progress to be made. I also think about a lot of the, you know, other stories that I haven't read before, like Funny House of a Negro by Adrian Kennedy.
That's a play. And it's a very abstract play.
Yeah. Yeah. Play. Or like Coming of Age in Mississippi by Anne Moody.
Right.
I mean, there's so much. And so when I saw everything, the list as a whole, but as well as with the GIFs or GIFs, whatever your pronunciation is, the art, it made me feel so full, and it made me humble because it taught me that, yeah, I read a lot, but there's always more to read about those who came before me and what that can say towards the future.
That's one of the important things, exciting things about doing this kind of archival and editorial work and bibliographic work. I was the volume editor of the Dictionary of 20th Century Culture, African American Culture volume, and it was a similar experience because I was digging. I worked in all of the areas of the arts, literature, of course, that's my specialty, but visual arts, poetry, dance. Film, and some of these things required that I learn, I study. That's why I took the project on, and it was such an eye-opener. And I want to congratulate you for doing this, but it's also just, as you say, a personally rewarding thing to be able to start digging around and thinking, oh, I never knew that. I didn't know this, you know,
right.
And then grow with the work itself.
Right.
We're revisiting a conversation from earlier this year about the Zora canon, which includes 100 of the greatest works by African-American women. Our guests are Sandra Adele of the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Morgan Jerkins, the senior editor at Zora. What about you? Have you read some of the works our guests have been talking about? Maybe you're getting ideas of what to put on your own to-read list. Is there an African-American woman writer whose work has really touched you? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know. We'll hear more of this conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening back to our conversation with Sandra Adell of the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Morgan Jerkins, senior editor at Zora. They are with us to talk about a newly compiled list called the Zora Canon. It includes 100 of the greatest works by African-American women going back to 1859. We want to hear from you. What African-American women authors have you read? What books, plays, or poems have made an impression on you? If you're African-American yourself, what works have you seen yourself reflected in? If you're not, what have you learned along the way? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Well, I'm going to reveal something about my preferences. The authors I've read the most on the list are Octavia Butler and N.K. Mm-hmm. Jemisin. I think if N.K. Jemisin put out, you know, her grocery shopping list in book form, I'd probably read it. Morgan, can you talk about the importance of getting a variety of genres, even science fiction and fantasy, like I like to read?
Because just to remind people that Black women write in all different types of genres, but also I wanted to speak to an industry problem. I mean, I have a lot of poet friends and they tell me all the time, like every time there are these comprehensive lists, poetry is often in the gutter, figuratively speaking. It maybe you have one or two sprinkling there, but that's it. So I definitely wanted to make sure that people saw that women, Black women write anthologies, poetry, plays, science fiction, children's book, all those sorts of things.
Sandra, you were nodding along
yeah,
there.
Yeah, she's absolutely right. Poetry and drama are the two areas in African-American literary studies that it's still in its infancy in many ways. And so that was the other thing that was so surprising to exciting to me, not surprising, but exciting that, yeah, she did it. She put that on there. You know, we got plays on there. She mentioned, you mentioned Morgan, Adrienne Kennedy, Funny House of a mm-hmm. Negro. I mean, mm-hmm. This was a major a playwright of the 1960s, but we hear very little about her, but a lot about Amiri Baraka. Yeah, right? And so the things that I'm looking at on my schedule that I'm teaching, I'm starting with Frederick Douglass. I switch off between Frederick Douglass one semester and Harriet Jacobs another time. It depends. You know, I switch these different courses. This is for an intro to Masterpieces of African-American Literature. And one of the early things that I know the question's going to be asked about the first few books is where are the women, where they're coming. You know, I've got it set up kind of chronologically. And that's another thing that's important to get this list out to people like myself, who've been teaching for years, to kind of, again, you know, bring some variety into it. Young people like science fiction. I need to get into the science fiction more. You know, it's not my genre, but it's important to present this to them. And this is another thing. I can't keep stressing enough how important it is that this is an online list. That's where young people go. You know, to get their information, and it's major. Now, one thing I do want to say is that people usually ask me what is my favorite book. It's probably Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. I've got many favorite books, but I keep going to it again and again. And this is one of those books where every time I read it, I find something new, and that's so exciting to me.
That's great. Well, do you have a favorite? I know it's hard to pick a favorite. Thank you for volunteering yours, Sandra. Morgan, do you have one that's like that you keep going back to?
I mean, she kind of took it for Uh-oh. Me, Dr. Adell. I was going to say right. Song of Solomon, man.
Yes.
Like, I mean, I would say Beloved. I mean, there's just so many, but I would Song of Solomon is that that's the top, right? That's the cream of the crop.
All right. Now, Sandra, can you talk about, I know at many points in American history, that point may include today, it's harder for women sometimes to get published than men, harder for Black authors to get published than white authors. Can you talk about the challenges over the years of African-American women authors just getting their foot in the door and getting their works published?
That hasn't changed. It's very, very difficult. And I don't know how, I guess the only way to make those changes and make it easier is to get more women in those positions, editorial positions and decision-making positions in publishing. You know, it's a tricky thing, though, because, you know, most writers have difficult times, difficulty getting published. But it's, you know, particularly if we're writing about ourselves in our lives, it's like, oh, no, you know, no one's interested. You know, who's going to be interested in the lives of Black women? Alice Walker proved that people are very interested in the lives mm-hmm. of Black women with the color mm-hmm. purple. mm-hmm. which now you know is, has been a movie and sure. is now a touring musical.
Uh-huh. So it did okay.
It did okay. It did okay. But again, people forget about the labor that went into this. And, you know, Alice Walker was an editor for Ms. Magazine before she started publishing novels. And she was, as Morgan mentioned, she literally resurrected Zora Neale Hurston. And young people everywhere seem, especially with their eyes are watching God, they seem to be very attracted to that. So that's another thing about this list. People know the name Zora.
We heard from John in Appleton who wants to know if there's a plan to get more African-American authored books in libraries and community read projects. Morgan, do you see that as one possible use for your Zora list that, a librarian somewhere could take this and build a display or two around it?
Oh, we have some really exciting news and other developments coming soon. So stay tuned.
Okay, so that might be something, John, that actually happens in the near future. You teach classes about all these authors, Sandra. Do you see things going on in libraries and public schools? Beyond the bounds of a university.
I can't say much about public schools because I'm surprised. I don't know what young people are reading today. It's like, when is the last time you read a novel, period? But with what's happening in the libraries, we're very fortunate here in Madison. We've got great librarians. I mean, we can go into any of these libraries here and find books by and about African-American women. That's another thing that you pointed out, though, or was pointed out, that this list is going to be of great use to people in places like Appleton or some of these small rural communities that have small libraries and they don't have the resources to find the work, that's on that list. So this is going to help them.
Morgan, you mentioned there are some developments in the works for the top 100 works by African-American women. But Sandra said earlier, we revisit the canon all the time. We come back. Are there plans to have more updated lists or more efforts to feature more current and contemporary authors?
I think that's something that we're definitely considering because as I noted the team has noted in the intro to the canon is that this is not 100% comprehensive. It's not 100% definitive. There are so many other works out there that we are discovering and rediscovering. So I think this needs to be a continuing conversation in the world of arts and letters and just in our respective communities.
And as we start to wrap up, Sandra, I think there was a time where we heard the phrase the great American novel, and it was usually by a guy, it was usually by a white guy about white people. Can you talk about the importance of considering other people as part of the American story and literature?
I think it's happening. This is one aspect. But we have to think of people of color, period, women of color, period. And it's going on. This is ongoing. Things are changing, but at the university level, the problem is what's happening in high schools or in community colleges. What are they reading? I don't know. That's the issue. And that's maybe something, I don't know if Morgan wants to take that on, but something that somebody else needs to look at. How can we change and affect the reading list of young people? By the way, one other thing to mention is that she's got young adult stories on that list too. That's important.
Well, I'll point people toward, if you look up Zora, that's Z-O-R-A, Canon, C-A-N-O-N, you will find that, or it's at the Zora website. You can check out the whole list there. Some great reading fun for us to look forward to. And that's all the time we have, Morgan. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And Sandra, thanks a lot for coming up today.
Thank you.
On this Juneteenth holiday, we revisited a conversation about the Zora Canon, a list that includes 100 of the greatest works by African-American women going back to 1859. We spoke with Sandra Adell. She's the F.U. Bascom Professor in the Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also the author of several books, including a memoir titled Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen and editor of the anthology Contemporary Plays by African-American Women, 10 Complete Plays. Morgan Jerkins also joined us, senior editor at Zorba, Medium's online space for women of color, and she led the team who put the Zora Canon list together. You can find the full list at zora.medium.com or find a link at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, county fairs have been canceled around the state. Farm reporter Pam Yonke is back with us for a look at the impact of those local fairs and what they mean for their communities. We'll find out why there's been a big jump in the number of low-income neighborhoods in the U.S. since 1980. And what do parents need to know about sending kids back to childcare during the ongoing pandemic? And how do we talk to kids to help them understand why certain safety measures are so important? We'll get advice and answers to your questions. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, it's a rough time for the economy right now. UW economist Menzie Chin joins the show for a look at the latest news and what to watch for in the months to come. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a trip down to the Bayou. It's Food Friday with a Cajun cook from South Louisiana. You can get started right now with a few recipes over at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.